Good evening. My name is Doris Little, and I'm the Senior Manager of Programs and Services at the National MS Society. I want to thank you for joining us this evening for the Maximizing Your Doctor Visit presentation. Before I introduce tonight's presenter, just a quick reminder that we are recording this evening's presentation, and it will be available on our website later this week. In addition, we will have an opportunity for Q&A at the end of this call. We will be monitoring the chat feature for any questions, and then we will also open up the phone line. So please join me in welcoming our presenter this evening, Kathleen Costello. Kathy is the Vice President of Access to Care at the National MS Society, and she is also a nurse practitioner at Johns Hopkins MS Center. Kathy, thank you, and I'll go ahead and turn it over to you.
Thanks very much, Doris. And thanks, everyone, for joining in this evening for this really very important topic of maximizing your doctor visit or making the most out of it. You know, this is something that's very close to my heart, and not at all because I have been a healthcare provider, but for several reasons, and maybe that's a little bit of it. But, you know, I remember when my kids were young, and they're now grown. But when they were young and we would go to the pediatrician office for a variety of reasons, I would not prepare because, for heaven's sake, I'm a healthcare provider. I can certainly handle a visit to the pediatrician. And I can't tell you how many times that I would walk out, get in the car, and think, oh, for gosh sake, I didn't ask ABC. And then I think, should I call? Should I not call? This is ridiculous. And I thought, you know, if you had just prepared a little bit, that might not have happened. Well, now it's, for my kids, 27 and 30 years later, and healthcare has changed, and our satisfaction with healthcare has also changed. We have far less time. You know, when I was a little kid, now this is really dating myself, but when I was sick, the doctor came to us, and, you know, I can remember Dr. Wells coming to my house and my mother running around and cleaning the house in preparation for the doctor. And even our primary care physician for the rest of the family would come to the house. Well, for the vast majority of people, that's sure not happening. And when you do go to see any of your physicians or providers, there's far less time. What used to be maybe a half an hour visit with your primary care is now 5 or 10 minutes. It's more expensive. Our co-pays have gone up, or your co-insurance. The reimbursement to the physician is far less. And the physician needs to have very specific documentation in order to get paid anything. Healthcare is much more specialized, whereas you could have gone to one person and maybe did years ago for the vast majority of your healthcare. Now, if there's a specific problem, there's often a specific referral that needs to be made to a healthcare provider. And our issues, particularly in MS, are very complex. They can't really be handled very well in 10 minutes. They certainly can't be handled if you have 5 or 6 issues going on. They're not going to be given any type of attention in a typical follow-up kind of visit. So all these reasons, the cost, the time, the need for documentation, the complexity, all of these factors have combined to make your responsibility as a consumer of healthcare and also the provider responsibility much greater. And it really requires that there's careful preparation and prioritization that occurs ahead of your healthcare visit. Next slide. So who should be your MS provider? So there's a lot of providers out there, and, you know, not everyone is going to be the right fit for an individual. Everybody has a different personality. There are providers who are warm and fuzzy. There are providers who don't even look at you, and they may be excellent at what they do, but it's their style that they're more interested in the facts and not hand-holding. And for some people, that might be okay. For others, not so good. What's their communication style? Again, do they like to look at the computer and you hear click, click, click throughout the visit? Or is it someone who makes eye contact and then speaks directly to you? What's their knowledge and expertise about MS? So when you're looking for a provider, you need to know about that knowledge and expertise, which can be gleaned by often seeing if they're involved in MS research, by seeing what's out there about them. If you Google someone, even contacting the office and asking, you know, about the people that they see with MS. Because not everyone is skilled in this area and not everyone has an interest in this area. So it's very important to know what that knowledge, the experience, and the interest of the provider happens to be ahead of time. Now, not always do you have multiple choices, right? So you may not have 10 neurologists to choose from because of insurance restrictions or just the number of people in your area. But you will try and find as much information out about the provider that you're going to be visiting as you can. Ultimately, you want someone who you respect and who you believe respects you. You need to have some level of comfort. Again, not everyone needs warm and fuzzy and hand-holding, but whatever it is that you need, you want that to be part of that relationship. You want someone who values your values and your priorities. Some people are okay if their provider says, I want you to do X, Y, Z without any conversation. But more and more, people really want collaborative decision-making. They want to be a part of whatever the decision happens to be. So someone who values that priority in you is very important. You, and again, want someone with an interest. Is this person interested in managing the myriad of complexities that are part of a lifetime of multiple sclerosis management? You also want to be sure that this provider is covered by your insurance. There's always a provider list, and not everybody in the community is on it. So that's an important consideration when making a choice. Next slide. So you're going to have a long relationship with your healthcare provider. Treatments can be complicated. Monitoring a treatment can be even more complicated. You may have relapses of your multiple sclerosis. You're going to need to know what you need to do to contact your physician. And what's the treatment going to be for an MS relapse? What about adherence? You want to feel comfortable that you can be honest. Are you really taking the medication? Are you participating in whatever the recommended treatment plan happened to be? And do you feel comfortable talking about that? Or you fear that you're going to be chastised for telling the truth? There may be potential difficult discussions that come up over your lifetime with multiple sclerosis. These may be around your employment, around disability. They may be around what kind of accommodations are appropriate and can the provider help you by letter writing or a conversation in getting those accommodations. What about disability? Many of you may already know that this can be a long and arduous process. It may take 18 months or more in order to finally be approved for benefits. What's the role of the provider and how does he or she see the role? Will it be letter writing? Will it be helping you with an appeals process? These things can be very, very important. There may be a change in your role and in your relationships over time, and you want to have someone in your corner to talk to about what's happening and how things are changing. At the very least, so that individual may make an appropriate referral for you to someone who you can have a more involved conversation. As many of you know, there are very difficult symptoms that are associated with multiple sclerosis, including mood disorders, sexual dysfunction, elimination problems, falling. Do you feel that this person that you're now expecting to be in this long-term relationship, do you feel that they can have these conversations with you? And do you believe that they're going to be able to provide you with help with these conversations? Next slide. So let's talk about specific appointment tips. So many of you have heard the three rules in real estate or the three priorities in real estate, right? So location, 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 right? So when you're preparing for an appointment, prepare, 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 okay? So I can't say it enough and stress it enough. You need to prepare on many levels for a visit, for your travel, for the content of the visit. What does that mean? What is that visit going to be about? And are you going to be able to remember to talk about all the things that you want to talk about and remember what the provider says back to you? What are the priorities? What are the recommendations. So you need to have somebody else with you. Who's going to be taking notes for you? Who's going to be that other set of eyes and ears? It's interesting, but we don't really remember a whole lot of what people say to us. Maybe about 20% of what we actually hear. So having someone with you is kind of critical. Some people ask if they can, if the visit can be recorded. There are some providers that feel uncomfortable with that. Others are perfectly fine. So these are things to think about. You have to prepare for the follow-up. Many recommendations may be made during a visit with your MS provider. Are you prepared to follow through with whatever those recommendations are? If they're physical therapy, if they're a medication, if there's some other treatment modality that is suggested for you, are you comfortable with being able to follow through? Because it's very frustrating if 3 or 6 months later, whenever the next visit is, the questions are, well, hey, how did that physical therapy go? And you say, well, I really didn't go. And there could be very valid reasons that could have been discussed at the initial visit. Perhaps you don't have the resources for the copay for physical therapy. Perhaps you have difficulties taking medication, and there's a medication with lots of side effects that was prescribed and you're afraid to take it. But again, that's part of what's going to be the follow through and the follow up. And are you prepared and able to participate in that? Because things need to move along over time, right? So if a plan is made, the next visit, the whole point is to evaluate the plan. Did it work? Did we get anywhere? Do we need to change it? And even better, you're going to need to know what if it, if you do follow through with the plan, but problems arise. What do you do about those problems? How do you address them in between the visits? Next slide. Insurance. I've mentioned this already, but it has a huge part in healthcare and our ability to access healthcare. So it's very important before you ever step foot in an office to know what your coverage is. Bring your always bring that insurance card with you and your own personal ID. So you need to know if you can have an MRI. Is it at a specific facility? Where can you have lab tests done? Where can you have things like physical therapy and occupational therapy? Because recommendations will be made. Prescriptions will be written. And it's important to know where these things are going to be able to take place. And this can be complicated. But again, it's part of those first three words, prepare, prepare, prepare. Next slide. So I can't stress this next point enough. It's very important to do your level best to be on time for the appointment. And if you can't make it, unless it's an emergency, which sure as heck comes up for many people, you need to call ahead of time that you just can't make it and reschedule. For many providers, these visits are very precious. And if it's a if you're a new patient to whatever the practice happens to be, a significant amount of time has been set aside for that visit that no one else can use except you. And if you're not able to get there for the visit, that's an empty slot that someone else could have had. So it's very important to know ahead of time, where are you going? Do you have the direction? Do you need transportation? Is it just a family member transportation, or do you need specialized transportation in order to get to the appointment? You should really, and particularly for a first visit, you should plan your travel to be to that visit 30 to 45 minutes ahead of time. You need to prepare. What kind of time do you need to get ready before you ever leave your house? You need to know, based on the time of your visit, if your visit is at 9 o'clock in the morning, you may have rush hour traffic to deal with, which will add travel time. And you, of course, and if you're anything like me, I might have a little difficulty getting out of a paper bag. So when I plan for getting anywhere, I have to plan that I might get lost. I might actually take that wrong turn. So I build that in a little bit of a buffer into my travel for taking that wrong turn and having to circle back. In many instances, there's a good distance between your parking facility and the office. In the office where I've been employed for some time, it's a very long walk from a multi-level garage to the front of the building. And a call ahead of time would let you know, is there valet parking? Is there special parking on every level, only certain levels? So again, that preparation ahead of time for directions, the actual distance, the time of day, the distance from the parking facility to the actual office, all very, very important for you to know ahead of time. So this is your first visit, and this is particularly important if this is your first visit to a neurologist for either diagnosis of your MS or you've moved and you're reestablishing your care in a new location. You must have the records sent ahead of time. I don't know of very many providers who have the time to pour through records at the same moment as the visit. If those records have been sent or someone has told you they've been sent, it's very critical for you to call the receiving office and say, hey, can you lay eyes on those records? Do you actually have them? And this includes the office notes, relevant lab tests that were done that led to a diagnosis, and recent MRIs. Now, if you've had, 14 MRIs over the last 10 years, it's probably not necessary to have every one of them. But if this is a new diagnosis or potential diagnosis, there's probably not been 14 necessarily. There may be a few, which will be important. And if you're reestablishing care with a known diagnosis, at least the most recent of those films will be important. And you can always ask the receiving office, how much do you want? How many of my MRIs are needed if you have multiple MRIs? It's a little easier these days when most MRIs are now on a disc. It was much more difficult when people would carry around literally 30, 40 pounds worth of MRI films. Very often, if you're a new patient to a practice, there are pre-visit forms. Sometimes it's a history form. Most often it's a history form. And it's very important to have those completed ahead of time. And if they are needed to be sent back, to send them back with plenty of time so that the office receives them. So this is obviously so that the provider can have an opportunity to review the records or at least the important points of the records. He or she will likely still ask you a ton of questions, and you may even think to yourself, didn't I send these records? Is there a reason why you're asking me all this? A lot of times it's to verify that information. I know for myself, I think I have given all the information, and then I'm asked the information or the questions again, and I might recall something else that winds up being a very important point to be made. So, you're going to be asked about your symptoms. What are they? When did they start? Have they changed over time? Have you ever had them before? What have you done about these symptoms? Were you evaluated for them? And what was the outcome of that evaluation? You can bet that any provider is going to ask you these, even if you have answered them and they're in a summary that you just sent to this person. If it's a first visit, my guess, for the reasons I stated a moment ago, you're going to be asked these again. So it's important to think that through. Write it down. It's a guarantee that's what's going to be asked. It's called the history of present illness, and that's the information. What is it? What are you experiencing? When did it begin? Have you ever had it before? Or have you had anything related to it before? So if it's a numbness or tingling, or if it's a weakness or incoordination or a visual disturbance, has any of that happened in the past? Because what the provider is trying to do is make a case. He or she is trying to establish what's called a differential diagnosis. What could this be? And the most important pieces of information are those that you come with, and that's your history. Without a good history, there will not be a good diagnosis. So the more you can provide and the more not only detailed, but concise and in order. If you're jumping from the present to 5 years ago to 2 years ago to 10 years ago, it's hard to follow, right? So again, prepare, prepare, prepare. Can you make this into a story, It started here, then it went here, then it went here, and I, you know, so that it's in order and easy to follow and understand. It will make that differential diagnosis list much easier for that provider to come up with. It's important to know your medical and surgical history. Okay, what other illnesses have you been diagnosed with? What surgeries have you had? What's your family history? Are there other autoimmune type of conditions in the family? Things such as lupus or thyroid disorder, Crohn's, psoriasis, of course, multiple sclerosis, because that helps in pointing, again, in a direction, putting together a list of the possibilities. You must know your up-to-date medications, and a list for that is most important. In many places, this will be asked of you before you ever see the physician, but accuracy is of utmost importance here. Not only what you're taking, but the dosage and the frequency of the medication, and what it's prescribed for. Also, supplements. We forget about these, but in many cases, they have very real effects. Your vitamin supplements, any complementary or alternative treatments that you're using are very important. It's very important information to share. And finally, your allergies. Okay, we sure as heck don't want to be prescribing anything that you're allergic to. So, and this is something that honestly should be asked at every visit because it changes. And it's a critical piece of information that everyone should ask over and over and over again. So again, it's all about the history. It's the information that you can provide, and if you can do that in an organized and succinct way, and be prepared for the questions that I've just mentioned, your history, your family history, your medications, your allergies, and then keeping with medications, supplements, complementary and alternative approaches that you may be using are all critical elements, particularly on that first visit, but also things that you're going to need on subsequent visits. Next slide. So what are the reasonable expectations for a visit? How long are they? This is some information that you can find out ahead of time by asking the office coordinator. But if you're establishing care, and this will be ongoing care, how long are the follow-up visits? Are they 10 minutes, 20 minutes, 30 minutes? What's the expectation? What happens during those visits? What is it going to look like? What kind of information exchange is the expectation for you, but also the expectation of the provider? And what's reasonable to accomplish in the follow-up appointment? You know, I don't have to tell you, MS causes a lot of different issues. You could easily have 10 different things that you need to talk about, but is it reasonable to consider that all 10 things will get a good evaluation and discussion in a 20-minute visit? So it might be more important to figure out how many issues and what's the priority of the issue when you're preparing for that visit. Is it okay to call? And if it is okay to call, what should you be calling about? If it's new symptoms, there's a physician that I met some years ago who would say to the people that he saw, I have a 24-hour rule. If your symptoms of MS persist, new symptoms persist for greater than 24 hours, I want to hear about them. If it's under 24 hours, it may be part of the daily fluctuations that unfortunately are part of multiple sclerosis. But when it's new and it's lasted for greater than 24 hours, it's probably worth a phone call. At least that was his thought on it. So it's important to know that. What kinds of things do you call about? When, as they're occurring, should you call? And when should you expect a return call? You know, if your expectation is that the provider is going to call you back in an hour, and the provider's expectation is that he or she is not calling you until the end of the day, nobody's going to be happy. So it's important to know, when does that call back occur? What's reasonable? And if it doesn't happen in that time, is it also reasonable for you to call again rather than just waiting for a callback that may never occur and now you're suffering with symptoms that potentially need attention? Next slide. So, again, prioritize and prepare. But, again, when you're prioritizing, what is it that you want to talk about? And this should be something that you think about the night or a few nights before your visit. what's been bothering you? What kinds of things do you really feel are critical for the discussion? Write it down. I can't stress that enough. I can tell you that visits go so much smoother when someone comes in and says, I have a few things that I'd like to discuss today. And then we're on. And they feel very satisfied that those things have been discussed. I feel satisfied that I've hopefully met someone's needs. But if you don't write it down, boy, it can be really tough. That whole white coat thing that happens with all of us, like I said, with the pediatrician visits, and all of a sudden you've forgotten the very thing that you wanted to talk about. So since time is limited, really what's most important? It's nice if you've written down all of the symptoms that you've had, but if your visits are occurring every 6 months, that might be a lot of information. So it might be worthwhile to summarize some of that information ahead of time. And if you have specific questions, again, write them down in priority order, just in case you don't get to all of them. You want to at least get to the ones that are of most importance to you. And then, as I mentioned earlier, those medications and supplements, keep them up to date. And someone may, again, ask you ahead of seeing the provider, but if not, you'll have that prepared so that that can be updated quickly. One other thing I didn't mention, oftentimes there's a need for medication refills. And in some systems, through the electronic medical record, it can be pretty simple to refill a prescription during a visit. But for other providers, that's not the case, and they may have a different system by which they want prescriptions refilled or your request for prescription refills to be done. So, again, it's very important to ask. Ask on that first visit, ask the office coordinator, what's the procedure here for when I need a refill. Do I call the office? Do I use an electronic medical record? How long in advance? Do I bring that to the visit with me? Or is there just too much going on? So knowing that information will help you and the provider. And most importantly, it means that there's not going to be a gap in getting your important medication. If it's a medication that another provider writes, but you're not able to reach that provider, it's not uncommon for your neurologist, your MS provider, to be unable to fill that prescription because it's not a problem or a medical issue that they attend to. So if you think you're running low on things, it's very important, again, to prepare but not wait until you're out of a medication before determining how you get that refill made in the best way possible. So don't be bashful. Okay, it's important to be able to talk about it. If your main priority is that you are having sexual dysfunction, it is important to bring sexual dysfunction up. If it's bowel or bladder issues, same thing. If it's depression, same thing. It has to be brought up. These are critical issues to your life. And if you don't bring them up, nobody's going to know. And I can tell you, just because it's hard for you, it may also be difficult for the provider. They're human too, and some providers are better than others in discussing sensitive topics. But if you don't bring it up, for sure, no one's going to be talking about it. Be very honest. If you're being asked, hey, are you taking all of your injectable therapy? Are you? The question is often, hey, are you taking your therapy? And if you're taking 3 out of 7 injections, you can say with all honesty, yes, I am. But that's really not the most honest answer. And if you're not able to take a medication, whatever it happens to be, regularly, there's reasons for that, and they need to be discussed. Is it a side effect issue? Is it fear? If you're on an injectable therapy, you know, that's not a trip to the beach. And it may be something that, you know, you're just having too much difficulty with. Do you believe that this medication, whatever it is, you know, it's just not working and I'm not taking it? That's a conversation that you should be having. To determine if you should be on it or maybe you shouldn't be on it. But one thing that people often do is they'll stop the medication, say nothing, and then come to the visit and say, well, I really didn't think it was working, so I stopped it 4 or 5 months ago. Well, that's 4 or 5 months that nothing was being done, and that's unfortunate. And my contention is that doesn't need to happen. These topics need to be brought up honestly and discussed. And if you've decided to do something in complementary and alternative world, it's very important to bring them up, because a lot of those interventions, they're definitely real interventions in real medicine, and they may be complementary, but they also may antagonize another treatment that you're on. And it's important to know that everything that you're doing is working synergistically or together for a common goal of helping you feel better. And not everything's going to be addressed in the single visit. It's a process. So again, prepare, but know that some things might have to be tabled until the next time that you come in. And I didn't mention this earlier, but perhaps it's important to know, how long in the future is that going to be? Are you seeing me every 3 months, every month, every 6 months, every year? Because a lot can go on in that period of time, and it changes the visit. Many people will see their MS patients every 3 or every 6 months, but that does vary practice to practice. And another important point to know up front, that's part of setting those reasonable expectations. Next one. And there are actually kind of a bill of rights that you're entitled to. You're entitled to be treated with respect, to have the ability to express your feelings and opinions with respectfully, to be listened to and to be taken seriously. It's so darn frustrating if you go to an office and you say, hey, I'd like to discuss diet in MS. And before you have an opportunity to really explain it, the provider says there aren't any diets in MS. End of discussion. Well, that's not being taken seriously. There's a lot of research going on around diet, and having a discussion could be very useful if that's your priority. Setting your priorities. Saying no and not feeling guilty. It's important to say, I'm not going to be able to do that. Is there anything else? And it can be frustrating, but it's more frustrating to say yes and then at the next visit find out that none of what was recommended was able to occur. You're paying for this visit, right? You and your insurance company are paying, and you deserve to have your needs met as best as possible. You should be able to ask for information. You know what? They make erasers on pencils for a good reason. None of us are perfect. And even though you wanted to follow through with something, you might have just forgotten. It's a lot of information that goes, there's been a lot of information I've said tonight, and there's a lot of information that goes back and forth in a visit. Again, having someone out there can be very helpful, but you might have missed something. And so you need to be able to make a mistake and not feel like you're going to be punished in some way for it. You may not be someone who wants to assert yourself. You know, you may need more of the provider that says, listen, this is what I think that you ought to do. Other people need to be part of that conversation. You need to be able to change your mind, right? You know, I mean, everybody has that right. It should be well thought out, and it should be communicated, but you may need to change your mind. Next slide. I think we have one last slide. There we go. And it's your responsibility to keep your appointments, to be honest, to give information freely and clearly and briefly. And this is that preparation piece again. It's very hard, if you haven't prepared, to be able to be brief and concise and organized. There's a lot going on, and it's a little nerve-wracking, right? It's a little nerve-wracking. There's some providers have a very commanding and intimidating presence, and anything that you prepared mentally may go right out the window. So having it written down is going to help you out a lot. You need to have respect for the provider and their time and their expertise and the others in the office. They're not always going to do things that are right either, or that seem to be respectful. They're allowed to make a mistake. They're not allowed to do that forever, and it may mean that you have to move on to see somebody else. If those things don't go your way in a visit, you know, the schedule got fouled up, suddenly you're not on the schedule, you've had to wait an inordinate amount of time, you know, maybe the doctor's running behind and now it's been 30 or 40 minutes, and you're angry. You know, you've got things to do. You've got an important life and a schedule. I would just recommend that despite the fact that that may make you angry, unless it's an ongoing issue, I would try and tackle that respectfully. And voice your concerns and your displeasure, but in a respectful way. know that no one has all the answers. We hope to have some of the answers, and we hope to work collaboratively to find answers and to make appropriate referrals so that all the needs that you have are being met in the best possible way. And it is a responsibility that if you say yes to a treatment plan, that you give it your best effort to try and follow through with it. If it doesn't work, it needs to be changed and a different direction needs to be taken. But if it's not tried, it'll probably come up again as something to do. And then precious time has been wasted. A colleague of mine in Canada said once that time is brain. And all of us, and particularly those of you living with multiple sclerosis, have precious brains that we need to preserve and maintain for our entire life. And in multiple sclerosis, that becomes even more important. So when time goes by and nothing is happening because of a variety of reasons, insurance coverage or side effects or just didn't like the medication or didn't think it was working, that time that you're spent on nothing is time wasted and time that that is dangerous for your personal brain health. So I think that's my last slide, and I'm going to stop there, and I'm hopeful that there's comments or questions that we can talk about.
Great. Thank you so much, Kathy. What a great presentation. Elaine, I'm going to go ahead and, I guess, turn it over to you to give us instructions on how to ask a question to the phone line.
At this time, in order to ask a question, press the star followed by the number 1 on your telephone keypad. That is star 1 on your telephone keypad.
Wonderful. Thank you, Elaine. And as you queue those up, when you're ready to open up some of those lines, let's just use first names, please. In the meantime, I'm going to go ahead and start with a couple of questions that came through on chat. So this is a question from Laura, and she says she has a very difficult time getting dressed and having the energy to get to a doctor visit. And then she has to consult with so many different doctors. Is there something she can do to avoid having so many different doctor visits for them to just get the same information that they can share? For example, blood pressure, et cetera.
Right. So I think it really is dependent, and I certainly appreciate the difficulties getting ready. That can be an enormous challenge for lots of reasons. And I think it's important to investigate what are each of these visits for to the various providers, and maybe talking to the main providers, for instance, the primary care physician and the neurologist, if there happen to be two main issues, to see if all of these visits are necessary and when are they necessary, right? Do you need to see everybody once a month or every 3 months, or how often can it be? But this is an excellent question to raise with your providers as to how often do we need to have a visit, and can we coordinate this with other providers because of the difficulties that are experienced in getting ready. Oftentimes, people have often asked me, too, if an appointment can be in the afternoon, because it's just so difficult to get it all together in the morning, get out the door, and get someplace. You need more time. So that's also something else to consider as well. But I think communicating ahead of time to see if there's a way that the visits can be reduced or consolidated that might be beneficial.
Great. Another question from the chat feature. This question is from Paulette. She says she has a lot of respect for her neurologist and her neurologist's interest and abilities, and she has a very open relationship with her neurologist and can speak freely. However, she seems to be that patient that is not the norm, so to speak. So she says, she seems doomed to always have the opposite reaction of the rest of her doctor's patients. And she feels like she's always being told, we've never had anyone mention this symptom or this side effect before. So how do you approach making a case for very real feelings and symptoms in a case like that?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's actually not such an unusual thing. I think it's pretty common, really, for people to have reactions that aren't in the, on the top 10 list, so to speak. But for that provider, it may be the first time, which may make it a little bit unusual. So unfortunately, I think that certainly can occur, but I think the message to providers is to be sensitive and respectful, because it can be very disconcerting to the person that's hearing that all of the time. So I don't think it's terribly unusual for people in general, but it may be for that particular provider. Maybe a provider sees 100 or 200 people with MS. Maybe they only see 50. So if they only see 50, there's going to be things that they've never seen before, right, that actually aren't so terribly uncommon. So I think it probably requires patience on the individual's part, but the message that I would certainly take back to providers is to have sensitivity to that issue. Do you think I've answered that completely, Doris? I had a little trouble hearing you.
Yes, I think that's as best as we can answer. And I would also, kind of piggyback on that, Kathy, and say that, as you talked about earlier today, we all need different things from our physicians. We all, handle things differently, expect, different things from our physicians. And it's really a very personal relationship. And what one person needs may not necessarily be what another person needs. And so, I would definitely encourage everyone that you just don't feel that you have a good relationship with your physician, that they're really listening to you, that they're taking the time, to answer your questions, in a thoughtful manner, that you're really getting most out of, your visit with them. It is definitely your right to look for somebody else. Talk with other people with MS that perhaps through your local self-help group, or call the Society's Information and Resource Center and ask for some referrals in your communities, and perhaps get a second opinion from another doctor. See if perhaps there's somebody that you can build that type of a rapport and a relationship with. Elaine, are there any questions on the phone line?
Yes, your first question comes from the line of Mary.
Hello?
Hi, Mary.
Hello. Hi there. Thank you so much for this. I struggle with this when I go see my neurologist every 3 months. And I'm trying to get him to do, how do you get your doctor to write down your symptoms, even when you've mentioned it in a previous visit, as I'm trying to establish a history that things are changing?
Okay, that's a great question. Thank you for that. So I would hope that the symptoms that you tell your doctor about are captured somewhere in the review of systems that they do, or in the history. Again, it's the HPI, or history of present illness, is a place where that information would occur. And I think if you have an open relationship with your neurologist, that it is important to establish a history, and a history of change over time, because if you do require something like accommodations at work, or maybe you need disability, or you're going to need a particular service that or intervention that requires insurance coverage, having the evidence, if you will, to substantiate whatever your need is very important. So if it's not being done in the way that I've mentioned, in that history or in the review of systems, I would ask about it. If you've specifically said, I'm having weakness or fatigue or cognitive or whatever the symptom happens to be, I would hope that it would come up in the written note, so it's established over time.
I've tried that a few times, and I've been told that, you've already mentioned it, so I just want to hear about your new symptoms. And I'm trying to establish saying, no, this has changed, but it's an old symptom, but I want it in the report. And that's where I am struggling.
Yeah, so if the symptoms, say you have them, but they're not, and they're ongoing, maybe there's some way that it could say that, ongoing symptoms. Sometimes I've seen it written, symptoms unchanged from the previous visit, or if it's worsened, symptoms unchanged except for symptom X, which is worsened in such a way. Maybe, you know, I'm sure that your provider is trying to be brief to get through a bunch of notes, but maybe there's another way that it could be written in there that at least it's not forgotten, so to speak. I think your worry is that it suddenly doesn't appear, so it's not part of your symptomatology any longer.
Yeah, that might happen.
Yeah. So I would just try again. I mean, I hate to say keep plugging, but, you know, I think if it, particularly if not having the symptom written down has caused you to be unable to get a particular service or a need met, then at least you can say, gee, I wasn't able to get this because it didn't appear in the note. And I was told that it was pretty important that this be in the note. Do you think it would be okay to put that in there? I mean, I don't mean for you to be subservient to this, but at least to be respectful, but also making sure that you continue to voice the need.
Yeah, that happened because they were not writing stuff down, and I got denied disability.
Oh, yeah. So I would bring that up because it may have been helpful to have that information there.
Okay, thank you so much, and I'll keep trying to prioritize and get the stuff written in.
Okay, it's a challenge for sure.
Okay. Elaine, another question from the phone line?
Your next question comes from the line of Maria.
Hi, Maria.
Oh, yes. Hi, thank you for taking my call. And this has been very informative and helpful, but I kind of have the same, you know, problems too. With actually, I'm on my third neurologist now, and the one that I'm going to now seems to be, you know, better and more, more considerate and more passionate. And I think at this point now he wants to even change my medication. I'm currently on Copaxone, but now he wants to change it to Gilenya.
Gilenya? Uh-huh, go ahead.
Right. Okay. And lots of times they say, well, you know, my symptoms don't sound like it's from the MS, but you know, what else could it be from? Because that's what I was diagnosed with. And it also took a long time to get diagnosed with. You know, it took them a long time to find it.
Mm-hmm.
Like after two MRIs.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, that was very frustrating.
The question, is your question about about symptoms that may or may not be related to MS?
Right. Yeah,
sure. Okay. So thank you for that. I will comment that diagnosing MS can be remarkably challenging. There are many, many conditions that mimic MS, at least for a period of time, often initially. And sometimes the way someone's MS starts is not in a very specific way, so that it's not easy to tease it out from these other conditions. And it's only over time, sometimes, that the diagnosis can be made. We are better at that in the current time because there are specific criteria and there's use of the MRI that help establish the diagnosis. But in symptomatology, the same thing can happen, particularly as we get older. More things happen to us as we get older, and as much as I believe MS should protect everybody from anything else that happens, it just doesn't do that. So we're still liable to get other things. And when we're 20 or 25 or 30, there's not a lot of other reasons, right? Which is why it's a little bit easier to diagnose things then. As we get older, other types of issues, just getting older, for instance, can be complicating the picture. So just like when you were diagnosed, teasing it out can take some time. And if there are other diagnoses that you may have, that may also make it difficult.
Right.
I'll give you an example. Sometimes people who have diabetes, for instance, I'm not saying that's you, but I'm just giving an example. Some people that have diabetes get a lot of numbness and pain in their extremities, particularly in their feet. Well, and that can cause that too. So if someone with diabetes winds up with pain, is it the diabetes or is it the MS? So, you know, there's an example of when it needs to be sorted out a little bit.
Exactly, right. Right. Oh, okay. Well, that's, you know, that really answered my question. And, thanks for, again, you were very helpful.
Great. Thank you, Maria, for your question.
Thank you, too. Thank you, too.
Okay. Let me work in a question from the chat feature. This question is from Catherine. She wants to know, what questions should one ask of a neurologist who is not an MS specialist? Right, so probably the most important question to ask is what is their, it's actually a two-part question, so what is their experience and interest in providing care in multiple sclerosis? That there's a lot of community neurologists who are not specialists who are excellent. They really know MS as well as a number of other conditions, and they provide excellent care. And there are those that really aren't as up on things. They don't see very many cases of MS, so it's harder to stay current with the treatments and risks and side effects and so forth. And there are some neurologists that simply do not have an interest. There's a fellow in my town who will provide diagnosis of MS, but once the diagnosis is made, he refers the individual to an MS center or another neurologist, if there's not an MS center in that person's area. So what's their experience and what's their interest are very important when they're not obviously an MS specialist who you hope has both experience and interest, right? Okay, great, thank you. Another question from the chat feature. This is from Diane, who says she is on Tysabri, JCV positive, told by different healthcare professionals that none of them really know how long she can be on Tysabri while being JCV positive. All of her MRIs have been stable. Do you have any guidance around that, Kathy? Right. So there are risks involved with being on Tysabri and having antibodies, the JC virus antibodies. Those antibodies indicate that there was exposure to the JC virus, and that's the virus that can become reactivated in people with MS who receive Tysabri as well as some of the other treatments, but certainly most notable with Tysabri. Having said that, there are many people who are positive for this antibody that continue on the treatment. And that's an important discussion about risks and benefits to have with your prescribing neurologist. JC virus antibodies are both, it's a qualitative and quantitative test. By that I mean qualitative is positive negative. Quantitative is how positive is it? What's the number? There's an index value that we can get that comes with the positive values. There's low and there's high. And there's reason to believe that for some physicians that when someone has low titer, perhaps that risk is less than someone that has a high titer or high index. And that makes sense. But there is risk involved. And the drug company and the FDA have indicated that risk in the product information. And it has to, the risk of PML is increased when you are JC virus antibody positive and you've had treatment for greater than 2 years, and even greatest if you have been previously treated with chemotherapy, like cancer therapy, and you're JC virus antibody positive and you've been on treatment for longer than 2 years. So those are all increased risk factors, and determining the how much risk is okay
is definitely a discussion to be had with the prescribing neurologist. What's acceptable risk? And when you say acceptable, what does that mean? What are my chances of getting PML in my given situation? That's a critical discussion to have, and it's also critical that you are clear on what that means to you, to be able to say this is okay or it's not okay. I hope that sufficiently answered your question. Because it's a very important one.
Great. Elaine, is there any more questions on the phone line?
If you would like to ask a question, an audio question, press star 1 on your telephone keypad.
Okay, so we have another question from the chat line, and this question is from Jill. Jill has relapsing remitting MS. Has had MS since 1985, and her neurologist says there isn't anything else they can do. And she wants to know if that is correct. Now, Kathy, obviously, that's a very specific question that may be a little bit hard to answer without knowing a little bit more specifically about Jill. But what would you say just to anyone who's been told, you know, I'm sorry, you have MS, there's nothing we can do for you?
Right. So this is an excellent question and unfortunately one that comes up often and issues that come up often. So I'm just going to give a little bit since we don't have a whole lot of time, so I'll be brief, but hopefully we'll answer this question for you. So in MS, the disease-modifying treatments that we have, and there's now, I believe, 13 of them, are indicated for people with relapsing remitting MS because they reduce inflammation, meaning they when people get new events on the MRI or new relapses of brand-new symptoms, there's often inflammation. And all of these medications are very good at reducing that inflammation. But people also develop a level of progression of their illness. And they, over time, often have less inflammatory changes. It's unclear, then, how well these very same medications work under those conditions. However, that's not to say there's nothing that can be done. There's always things that are important to be done, actually critical to be done. Disease-modifying therapies are not all that there is in the treatment of multiple sclerosis. It's important to note that rehabilitation strategies, regular physical activity, even exercising the mind to keep it active, are critical elements. Making sure that your weight is optimal. If you're smoking, quit smoking. There's evidence that smoking is bad, and quitting smoking is not only good for your lungs and your heart, but it's good for your MS. So there are things that need to be done all the time. Physical mobility and activity, a critical element no matter what type of MS anyone has told you you have. If you are less mobile, even more important to have exercises that can take place in a seated position so that there's things that should be able to be done all of the time. Some of them will be medication, some of them will not. That's not to say that one's more important or less important than the other. All of this is part of the whole treatment plan for multiple sclerosis over the lifetime.
That's great. And perhaps Jill is a prime candidate for seeking a second opinion.
There's that.
Elaine, are there any other questions from the phone line?
Yes, you have a question from Laura.
Okay. Laura, please go ahead.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I was the first question, actually, about multiple appointments where I have difficulty getting ready, and like your lecture mentioned, you might have to see several providers, and they might only have a few minutes or 10 minutes or so to spend with you. I've tried to tell people, the doctors themselves or their nurses sometimes, that it's very, very difficult for me to get ready. Additionally, my husband has to take off of work to drive me because I don't drive, and they don't seem to make that important. I have to come in, have my blood pressure checked, or to change the dose of a medication I'm already on, and it seems like they treat me like a difficult client. They do, if I resist that. So I do not know what patients do when they cannot get ready or have a way to get to an appointment, but I feel like I'm approaching that point, and so far they have not been willing to work with me. Can you please address this?
Sure. Thanks so much for asking again. And again, as I said earlier, this is a pretty tough topic. Without going into all the specifics of your particular case, there are likely reasons why they need to see you, but I would ask that perhaps you and a family member, and that family member could help to advocate on your behalf as well to discuss the need for frequent visits and could they be reduced in frequency or could they be consolidated so that you're not making multiple trips to a particular location. And I would be persistent with that. You have a voice here. And in addition to you, if there's someone, a family member, who can help to act on your behalf, kind of as your agent, if you will, that can also help to have this conversation because of the difficulties that you have. It may not occur after the first or second or third try, but if this is truly an issue for you, which it sure sounds like it is, then I would be persistent in trying to get some of these visits changed or consolidated. I wish I had a magic bullet to say this is what you need to do to fix it, but my best advice is for you to be persistent and to maybe have someone help advocate on your behalf.
Thanks.
All right, great. Thank you, Kathy. So I show that we are at the top of the hour, and so we are out of time for this evening. But, Kathy, I want to thank you for taking the time to talk about such an important topic with us tonight. And I want to thank everyone for joining us. I do have four quick polling questions that I'm going to show on the screen at this time. And for those of you who are joining us online, I would ask that you submit your answer by clicking in the center of your screen. So the first question is, are you a partner, a family member, or a person with MS? Please select the answer in the center of your screen. Okay. Next question. Was the material presented relevant to you? Yes or no? Please select your answer in the center of your screen. Okay. Next question. Were the speakers and the information they presented easy to understand? Yes or no? Please select the answer in the center of your screen. And finally, did you learn something new from this presentation? Yes or no? Please select the answer in the center of your screen. And that concludes this evening's presentation. Again, a reminder, we did record this, and it will be available on our website later in the week, along with a copy of the actual PowerPoint presentation. And for those of you who are online, I posted that URL when we opened up the conference on the chat feature. So definitely make sure to check that out and share it with anyone that you think it might be helpful. Thank you, Kathy, again. Thank you, everyone, for joining us this evening. Have a great night. Thank you.
This concludes today's conference call. You may now disconnect.